So, thank you. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, Asia Foundation, Asia Society, I want to welcome you to our event this afternoon. My name is Philip Young. I'm going to be your moderator. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guests. His Excellency An Ho-young was appointed Ambassador of the Republic of Korea to the United States by Madam President Park in May 2013. He is a career Foreign Service officer and has had a long and distinguished career in many important posts throughout the world, which you can see on his bio. I also have the pleasure of introducing former Congressman Donald Mazzullo, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Korean Economic Institute of America, and he will be discussing the growing importance of U.S.-Korea relations and Korea's emergence as an increasingly influential country in the region. Please welcome Representative Mazzullo.
Well, good afternoon. It's a real joy to be here. I served several terms with Congressman Doug Bierider, and many of you probably know him. He and I were very close friends, remain very close friends, and in fact, we served on the transition team when Hong Kong lost its lease and reverted back to mainland China. It's a real honor to be here, especially having the opportunity to be with our brand new ambassador from Korea, who brings a tremendous amount of energy and wisdom and a lot of wit to his post. I left Congress in January this past year and assumed the responsibility of KEI 2 hours after my term expired. So I had a two-hour retirement before I went back to work again. The mission of KEI, which was formed in 1982, is to promote dialogue and understanding between the Republic of Korea and the United States of America on economic, security, and other issues. This year, we celebrate the 60th anniversary of the U.S.-Korean alliance between the United States and the Republic of Korea. We, of course, don't forget that more than 36,000 U.S. troops died to defend a country, quote, they never knew, and a people they never met, end of quote. It's a privilege for me to lead this organization because Korea is such an interesting and dynamic country. Take a look at all that's going on in the world. Everything's happening in the peninsula. And that's exciting, to be around people that are continuously challenged and continuously work very hard to make Korea an even stronger country. And that's not because of just the leadership alone. And it's not just because of Psy, but because of the people. No other country in the world has distinguished itself as much as Korea has in a little over two generations, coming from a country with no natural resources, no manufacturing base, abject poverty, and recipient of foreign aid to becoming the 12th largest economy in the world in just two generations, and now it's a foreign aid donor. Unparalleled in history that a country could grow that quickly. Korea's on the move, and Korea is really the bridge to Asia. Thomas Friedman has said that there will be two types of countries going forward: high imagination enabling countries, HIE, or low imagination enabling countries, LIA. In other words, countries either foster creativity and innovation, or they stifle curiosity and passion and stagnate. And I'm proud to be associated with two high-end HIE countries, the United States and the Republic of Korea. South Korea has the second highest college graduation rate in the world. 1 out of 10 foreign college students studying in the United States today is Korean. 38% of the degrees awarded in the United States are in the STEM field. In the United States and in Korea. Former U.S. Trade Secretary, Representative Susan Schwab, recently spoke at a KEI function in Washington, and she said something quite remarkable. And she said, other nations will look to Korea for guidance on issues beyond the Korean Peninsula because of its growing stature in the world. on diverse issues, such as climate change, because of the location of the UN Green Climate Fund in Sanggo, nonproliferation. Korea hosted the Nuclear Security Summit in 2012. To the Arctic, Korea was granted observer status on the Arctic Council. And in the United States, 1.7 million Americans of Korean descent live here. California is the home to the nation's largest population of Korean Americans. Representing the ninth largest source of foreign visitors, over 1.25 million South Koreans came to the United States in 2012. It's an increase of 9% over the previous year, spending $4.2 billion, an increase of 10% over the previous year, and San Francisco is one of America's top tourist attractions. The latest data from the Census Bureau shows Asians are the nation's fastest growing race or ethnic group in 2012. And according to Census, over 267,000 individuals of Asian descent live in San Francisco. So America has a natural bridge to Asia right here in San Francisco. South Korean investors are dramatically increasing purchases of U.S. commercial real estate, going from less than $200 million in 2009 to $1.8 billion during the first half of 2013. The San Francisco metropolitan area is the 12th largest export market for the U.S. and exported more to Asia, $9.3 billion, than to any other region in the world in 2012. Asia is San Francisco's largest exporting port. Nearby San Jose, Sunnyvale is number nine. In fact, South Korea is San Jose's third largest export market at $2.4 billion, ahead of China and Japan. And Korea only has 49 million people. Korea is also the source of growing foreign investment in the United States. In the area where I live, in northern Illinois, Regal Cutting Tools of Roscoe owes its existence to some very wise investors from the Republic of Korea. So it's a real joy to be associated with the people of Korea, and a super joy to be associated with our new ambassador. Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman Manzullo. Now it is my pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, to introduce His Excellency An Ho Young.
Well, so glad to see all of you after so many years. And then when I say after so many years, I really mean it. And then what I mean by that is this, which is that I used to work for the Korean Embassy in Washington, D.C. from 1990 up until 1993. And then I guess it was sometime in 1991, if I'm not mistaken, October 1991, I was invited by the same group, World Affairs Council at the time, to come and speak to you. That was in October 1991. And then you'd wonder, well, 22 years ago, he was the first secretary, how come we demeaned ourselves to such a level as to invite the first secretary? And then the thing is, at the time, you extended your invitation to my ambassador at the time. Ambassador couldn't make it, so he made me to come in his place. And I said to myself, what a pleasure and honor. So I didn't mind taking a plane for 5 hours and make a speech. And then just after spending one night, then I came back to Washington, D.C. at the time. So that's what I remember about my previous visit to San Francisco, as well as to World Affairs Council. And then I'm coming back here as an ambassador after 22 years. And I said it to somebody yesterday. And then that somebody told me, well, you can test the audience if they remember my first meeting with you 22 years ago. I don't think the chance would be very, very high, right? I don't think that would be very likely. I'm looking around the hall, and I guess maybe some of you were not even born at the time, right? So I'm here, and thank you so much, Mr. Manzullo, for this, very insightful introduction to my country, as well to myself. And I think he's quite new as a director for the KEI. But before that, he used to work as a chairman of Foreign Affairs Subcommittee, House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Asia and the Pacific. So certainly he's not new. I mean, he has very good understanding of our part of the world, and then it is, of course, our great joy and pleasure to have him as a leader of Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. So Mr. Manzullo has already shared with you all the things I wanted to share with you, so I think I can be relatively brief, and I just wanted to start from one of the points which Mr. Manzullo has made, which is this is 60th anniversary of security alliance between Korea and then the United States. And then I'm wearing this small badge, and then for me it was too small, so I requested Baek Seoul to enlarge it by one and a half times. Why? Because it stands for 60, meaning 60 years of relationship between Korea and then the United States. When I say relationship, then 60 years ago it was the ceasefire of the Korean War. And on the eve of the ceasefire of the Korean War, the great thing happened between Korea and then the United States. There was mutual security alliance treaty between Korea and then the United States. Why do I call it a great event? Because it was thanks to this treaty and thanks to this security relationship that we could do all the things which Mr. Manzullo has just described to you, economic development, political development, and then development in other areas as well. So let me start from there. And then when I say let me start from there, we in fact are deeply appreciative of what has happened between our two countries over the past 60 years. And big question will be, what will happen in the days to come? That in fact is a big question in my mind, and then that it's a big question which is shared by many people back in Washington, D.C., who work on the relationship between Korea and then the United States. I have a very simple answer for that question, which is the relationship between Korea and the United States, it will develop from strength to strength. That's my simple answer. And then I have hundreds of reasons why I believe in that, but this afternoon, let me share only three of them. First is, well, because of diversity and depth of the relationship we have built over the past 6 years. 6 years ago, as I told you, it started as a security relationship. Then soon enough, we began to develop economic relationship, which was very important. And then soon enough, we began to develop something called global partnership between Korea and then the United States. That's the reason. Some alliance, they remain there for single purpose. And then when that single purpose has been achieved, then that kind of alliance, they just peter out. But in case of Korea-U.S. alliance, it started as a security alliance, but it began to grow with diversity of issues, with the depth of issues, economic issues, diplomatic issues, et cetera, et cetera. So because of this diversity, as well as depth of relationship, I'm very confident that our relationship would continue to strengthen in the days to come. My second point would be because of the common positions we have and then common perspectives we have on so many important issues we face in the international community today. And then I can tell you that out of my own personal experiences, I have had the pleasure of representing my own country, Korea, at various international fora, including United Nations, APEC, WTO, OECD, G8, G20, major economies forum, you name it. Somehow, during the 35 years I have spent in the Korean Foreign Service, I have had the personal experiences and honor of representing my country in all those international fora. What never ceased to surprise me was, well, on so many different issues, I always found myself on the same side with the United States. On economic issues, on climate change issues, on human rights issues, on security issues, on proliferation issues, well, on so many different issues, at so many different fora, I just happen to admire the fact that I somehow always might find myself on the same side with the United States. So much so, it happens from time to time that I get a note from, say, my American colleagues. It says, well, Ho-young, I want you to speak up. That kind of notes are being sent to me when I come to international meetings. And then why would my American colleagues would say that? It's because they know I will be speaking on behalf of the United States, right? So that is my second reason. I mean, on so many important issues, we, in fact, have same perspective. We, in fact, share the same positions. This is my second reason why I'm so confident about the relationship we will develop, we will continue to develop between Korea and then the United States. My third point, I mean, why I'm so confident about our future relationship is because the depth of interest we have in each other. Let me start with my observation and my understanding about your interest in Korea. Then, as I told you, back in 1991, I came to speak with you, World Affairs Council, and then it was not the only opportunity. During my 3 years of service in Washington, D.C., I was invited to speak to American audience. Sometimes invitation was to me, sometimes invitation was extended to my ambassador, and then he passed up those invitations to me so that I will come and speak to you. After 3 years, I tried to count how many times I had the opportunity to meet with American audience. After 3 years, I counted no less than 30 times, including the visit I made to San Francisco in October 1991. So I was extremely gratified about it. Several years later, I came back to Korea, and several years later, I was sent to one of the European countries. And then in Washington, D.C., I used to be first secretary. In that European capital, I was something called a counselor, far more, say, elevated position. And I was just wondering how many opportunities I will have in that European capital of speaking with the European audience on issues related with Korea and on issues related with Northeast Asia. So I spent 3 years, and I was leaving that town, leaving the city, after 3 years of assignment in the town. And then how many meetings I had with the citizens of that country? Zero. That was the level of interest that a particular country had in Korea. But here, in the United States, as I told you, I had no less than 30 times of opportunity to speak with citizens of the United States. That, in fact, speaks a lot about the level of interest you have in my country. What about our interest in the United States? Well, Mr. Manzullo, he was kind enough to remind you that we have no less than 70,000 students studying at graduate as well as undergraduate level in this country. By nationality, 70 means third largest by nationality, right? First comes from Chinese. How many Chinese are in this audience? Quite many, right? Quite many. Well, from China, we have 200,000 students studying in this country, 200,000. That's so number one from China. Number two, Indians. How many Indians do I have in the audience? Only one, right? But from India, we have 100,000 students studying in this country, right? But let us try to put those figures against the number of general population in China as well as in India. How large is the population of China? 1.3 billion, if I'm not mistaken, right? 1.3 billion, which is 30 times as large as the population of Korea, which is less than 50 million, right? How large is the population of India? More than a billion, close to 1.3 billion once again. So again, 30 times larger than Korea, right? So in terms of population, China, India, they are 30 times large, right? But in terms of number of students you have, United States has. In this country, 200,000 from China, 100,000 from India, 70,000 from Korea, right? What does it signify? I think one of the things which it tells is Korea is a lot interested in this country, in the United States, right? So that will be my third point. I mean, we are so much interested in each other, and then because of all these reasons, I mean, because of diversity and depth of the relations we have developed over the 60 years, and because of all these common interests and positions that we have on so many important international issues, and this intensity of interest we have in each other, I'm very confident about the future of our relationship between Korea and then the United States. But at the same time, complacency is the last thing we want to have, right? We must not be complacent about the future of our relationship. So as an ambassador in Washington, D.C., I will continue to work to think about how we can further strengthen the relations between Korea and the United States, because I'm confident that it is the single most important relationship for Korea. I think it was Winston Churchill who coined the word special relationship. And then he coined the word, Churchill coined that word, in order to characterize the relationship between Britain and United States. And I just want to say, well, Korea is another country which thinks we have very special relationship. Let me put very as well. Very special relationship between Korea and then the United States. And then I have, this confidence that we will be able to further strengthen this very important relationship, very special relationship. But at the same time, I tell you, we will not be complacent, and then we will continue to work to further strengthen the relations between our two countries. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. We now go to the question portion of our program. I know that you are seeking to focus mostly on the U.S. ROK relationship, but not surprisingly, a number of questions have to do with North Korea. So I think it's really quite appropriate that we've saved a lot of those remarks for you in the question session that we have here. We know that North Korea over the last previous 6 months has done a number of provocative acts. We've had a missile test. We've had a nuclear test, threatening of a nuclear preemptive attack on the United States. And suddenly it stopped. And now we've had about 2 or 3 months in which North Koreans are kind of making nice. We've had some time to reflect a little bit on what has happened. And so knowing that South Korea really has significant insight into what is going on in North Korea, I think people here are very curious to know what is your take, or the South Korean government's sort of take on what North Koreans' motivations were for the last 6 months and what they're actually doing. What is your view on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, somebody suggested that there are two phases in North Korean external behavior. And then those two phases would be, one phase would be very hostile phase, and then another phase would be less hostile phase. And then somebody said, some people say the charm offensive on the part of North Korea, but at the same time, charm offensive, it will be too much. It will be very hostile phase and then less hostile phase. So, Philip, I'm listening to you. And then during the past several months, then, of course, we have been experiencing North Korea to be taking this less hostile position. And then what is our take of this alternation between, say, very hostile position and then less hostile position? Maybe there would be various reasons why they are alternating between the two. But what is important for us, for Korea, and then for the United States, would be, we'll be prepared for both phases. When they are very hostile, then of course we'll be very firm with North Korea. And then they say, well, there is nothing you can get out of assuming those very hostile positions. And then when it comes to less hostile positions, then again, both Korea and then the United States, we must be very firm and then say, well, we welcome you to be less hostile, but at the same time, you must not expect that you will be rewarded for being less hostile. There are certain very important principles that we have. And then unless our dialogue is based upon those very important principles we have, then you will not have it your own way. That is to say, dialogue is important in any relation, with any relationship, like any relationship. Dialogue with North Korea is important,
But at the same time, we must make it clear to North Koreans that we will have it on our terms rather than on their terms. And when I say on our terms, it should be based upon principles. And then what would that principle would include? First of all, we cannot condone nuclear development in North Korea. We cannot condone proliferation of weapons of mass destruction in North Korea. That's principle one. Second principle would be we want to see more freedom. We want to see more human rights in North Korea. That will be principle two. So, well, it will be based upon these principles that we will continue probe the possibility of having dialogue with North Korea. But at the same time, I think it must be a dialogue from which all the actors can benefit. It must not be dialogue for dialogue's purpose. So that's how we take this alternation of North Korea between very hostile and then less hostile phases.
So the questions that some people asked are, give us some sense of what you think, and again, obviously it's not complete. Why? What does North Korea want? You can have dialogue, but there's this discussion about, is there something that you think or they've talked about that they specifically want from South Korea or the United States?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just try to quote somebody rather than coming out with my own views. Let me just try to quote somebody. And then that somebody is somebody called Mr. Victor Cha. And then Victor Cha used to work for the NSC, National Security Council, during President Bush's time. And then for the time being, he works for the CSIS. And then the reason why I want to cite him is because several months ago, he wrote an article for one of the newspapers in Korea exactly on that title. What does North Korea really want? That was the title of this article by Victor Cha. And then he said, well, of course, we can only guess. But our guess is maybe North Koreans want two. First, it wants to establish itself as a nuclear state. Second, maybe North Korea wants assurance for the Kim family. I mean, it will not be assurance for North Korean regime. It will not be assurance for North Korea. It will be assurance for the Kim family. Maybe that's what North Korea wants. Maybe that's what Kim family wants. So again, the reason why it is important that we base our relationship with North Korea on firm principles is exactly because of that. In other words, it is because we cannot condone nuclear development in North Korea, and then we cannot place the interests of the Kim family ahead of the interests of North Korean citizens, that we will have to be very firm on the principles.
So I will not, a couple more questions on North Korea and then we'll move on, but there are a number of questions that have to do about the future of North Korea. And some of them are concerned about the possibility of North Korea imploding economically or socially, mm-hmm. and wanted to know how and what if you think that is something that we do need to be concerned about, and if so, what should we be doing, both the United States and South Korea together?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, when it comes to sensitive issues, let me try to quote somebody else, right? So, Philip, I guess short answer to the question would be, we must be prepared. And then a little bit longer answer would be, well, again, I'm quoting the same gentleman, Victor Chow, at the CSIS. He started a project of intensive studies about what United States should be doing against the possibility of implosion, economic or other implosion of North Korea. And I think CSIS is making a very helpful effort by doing this research. But as I told you, let me just stop there. We must be ready.
Okay. Right. The final question on North Korea has to do with a topic that we had here at the World Affairs Council, which drew a lot of interest. It has to do with human rights in North Korea. Yesterday, Shin Dong-hyuk, who is a North Korean born in political prison camps, who later escaped and has just testified before the commission of inquiry established by the UN. And in fact, the World Affairs Council and the Asia Society sponsored an event here by featuring the author of a book by Blaine Harden, who wrote about Mr. Shin and his story, which was awful, gruesome, and compelling all at once. And I know that there are a lot of people here who are very concerned about what's going on in North Korea, and I think there are a lot of younger Korean Americans and people who are just concerned about the world in general and how we treat each other about what they can do. And so maybe from your perspective, can you tell me a little bit about what the South Korean approach is on North Korean human rights, and perhaps maybe some of your thoughts about what we can do here in the United States to help the situation?
Mm-hmm. Well, as a matter of fact, you are right in the sense that there is somebody called Mr. Darusman, and then Mr. Darusman is a special rapporteur appointed by Human Rights Council at the United Nations as a special rapporteur on human rights situation in North Korea. So he has been, acting as special rapporteur for that important subject. And then, for him, it was a rather frustrating experience. I mean, working as a special rapporteur on human rights situation in North Korea, it was a rather frustrating experience for him, as well as for many of his predecessors. So what he proposed was to come up with a council of Commission of Inquiry, COI, into the human rights situation in North Korea. So that COI has been formed, and then of course there's a COI on human rights in North Korea. Then of course the best thing, or the necessary thing this commission would have to do, it would be to come and visit North Korea. But as you can easily imagine, that visit could not be arranged. So instead, that commission is visiting Korea. So presently it is in Korea. And after that, it is planning to visit Japan. And then, as Philip rightly pointed out, that commission met with some of quote-unquote witnesses. And then one of the witnesses was Mr. Shin Dong-hyuk, who came to meet with you earlier on. And then it was covered in the New York Times this morning. And I read that the article, and then what it said was that, well, all those gruesome descriptions of violation of human rights in some of the concentration camps in North Korea. And then it was all described in that article. And then it went on by saying, well, all those stories are gruesome, but at the same time, it is nothing new. But what is new is, well, Shin Dong-hyuk, he appeared before the Commission of Inquiry. So that, I think, is an important process in the sense that, well, I think this awareness about human rights situation in North Korea being widely held by American citizens, of course it is very helpful, but at the same time, I think what we are beginning to observe is now that awareness is being channeled into more institutionalized process, and institutionalized process being meaning Commission of Inquiry. So it's a step ahead, and then what we should be doing in order to improve the human rights situation in North Korea, we should be alert about it. I mean, we should let it be always on our agenda, so that once we forget about it, then of course there will be nobody, no assistance that citizens of North Korea could be expecting to get in the days to come. And then that will be the most terrible thing to happen. Moon Tae-fon is the main name of special rapporteur for human rights situation in North Korea before Mr. Darusman. And then Moon Tae-fon said something terrible, and then it said, well, in North Korea, they have more than 250,000 people in concentration camps. What does 250,000 people mean? It is more than 1% of North Korean population. And who in the world would be having 1% of its own population in concentration camps? But it doesn't matter. Again, this is what Moon Tae-fon said. It doesn't matter. Why? Because North Korea itself is a huge concentration camp. This is what Moon Tae-fon said. And then that is the reason why in the United States, in Korea, and in all the free world, we must keep this issue on our agenda. That way, we'll be able to work out something to improve the situation in North Korea.
Okay. Let's switch then from North Korea to something and move back a little bit, and let's look us to more regional issues. I think that President Park, when she was here earlier, I believe it was in May, gave a very impressive speech to a joint session of Congress. And there she talked about a Northeast Asia peace and cooperative initiative, which has been dubbed the Seoul Process. And she sort of outlined sort of her vision of what that looks like. A number of questions here talk about China. They talk about Japan, which is Northeast Asia and what it looks like. And so I was hoping that you could elaborate a little bit more on this. How does it affect the United States? I mean, this is something that is very much, I think, front and center in terms of U.S. policymaking, in terms of what they're thinking about for Northeast Asia. And because South Korea is such a close partner, obviously there's got to be a lot of consultation that occurs by the United States and South Korea about what that all looks like. So I was hoping this might be an opportunity for maybe you to talk a little bit about that vision, and then we can maybe move on to maybe some specific questions about China and Japan.
Well, thank you. Well, let me start with the background of this proposal coming from my president, President Park. And then there's the proposal of dialogue for peace and prosperity in Northeast Asia. And then let us just think about East Asia for the past 60 years. In the past 60 years, I guess countries in East Asia, they had certain collective experiences. And then in that collective experience, there were three major challenges that countries in Northeast Asia had to deal with, or in East Asia had to deal with. First challenge was the challenge of economic growth. And then it will be a challenge anywhere in the world. But there is a certain context to the issue of economic growth in East Asia. Why? Because of where they started from. They didn't start from most favorable conditions. And then Mr. Manzullo, he said it was Korea, for example. Korea was one of the most impoverished countries 60 years ago. And then there was one Nobel Prize winner for economics, Mr. Gunnar Myrdal. He wrote in 1964 a book called Asian Drama. And then in that book, he described why, in his view, economic growth in Asia would be very difficult, if not impossible. So that was Gunnar Myrdal's understanding of objective conditions for economic growth in East Asia at that time. So we had to fight against that odds in order to develop our economies in East Asia. So the first challenge, I think, was somehow met. The second challenge we had to face rather collectively in East Asia was the challenge of Asian financial crisis back in the late 1990s. At the time, I used to work for the Korean mission to the OECD when Asian financial crisis broke out in a large number of Asian countries. When it happened, then, of course, the enormity of the challenge was huge. Just one example would be the exchange rate between Korean won and the U.S. dollar. It used to be less than 900 won to one U.S. dollar. At the height of the crisis, it was 2001 to one U.S. dollar. Can you imagine? From less than 900 won to 2001 in a matter of several weeks. So that, in fact, would be one example of enormity of the challenge we had to face at the time. But somehow we could overcome it as well. At the time, as I told you, I used to work for the Korean mission to the OECD, and many of my OECD colleagues, they were telling me, after some time, you will realize it was a blessing in disguise. I didn't like that. I said to myself, it is a very paternalistic statement coming from my OECD colleagues. But there came a moment when I came to realize, in fact, they were blessings in disguise. And then when was the time? It was in 2008. 2008, we had the global financial crisis, and somehow East Asian economies, they could go through that global financial crisis without too much difficulties. And at the time, I used to work as G20 Sherpa for my president, and I said to myself, maybe one of the reasons why we are being able to do this, that is to say, go through the global financial crisis without too much difficulties, is because of what we did back in late 1990s, of putting our house in order through reforms of large measure. Reform of our financial sector, reform of our corporate sector, reform of our public sector. It was very painful when we did it, late 1990s. But after going through all those reforms, then of course our banks, our companies, our government came out with far more solid capital compositions. We were far more in a better position to deal with the global financial crisis when it broke out in 2008. So that was the second collective challenge we had to go through in Asia, in East Asia. But now, I think collectively in East Asia, we are facing with a third challenge. And third challenge is deep split between economics and politics. And then what I mean by that is, when it comes to economic relationship, it is getting ever closer among Asian economies. The economic relations among East Asian economies, it is getting ever closer. But it is not being repeated in the political arena. It is just the opposite. There are increasing number of historical disputes, there are increasing number of territorial disputes, there are increasing number of incidents caused by narrowly defined nationalism. That's the reality we face in East Asia. So there is a big split between economics and politics. So I, in fact, was observing the split, and I was beginning to be concerned about it. And last year, President Park used to be one of the presidential candidates, and she spoke at one of the seminars in Seoul, organized by Joseon Daily in Seoul. And then there, she was describing the phenomenon, that is to say, split between economics and politics. And then she used this expression, which is Asian paradox. I read it, and I said to myself, I will use it myself. Asian paradox. That is to say, in Asia, economically, our relationship is getting ever closer, but somehow it is not being repeated in political relationship. Well, it is just the opposite. It is getting worse. So she described the third challenge we are having in Asia. But as a candidate, she didn't have an antidote for the challenge we had. And then we had to wait until she was elected as president. And then, as Philip rightly pointed out, she came to Washington, D.C. And then she was speaking to the joint session of U.S. Congress. And then she said, well, we have this paradox in Asia, and maybe we have to do something about it. And then that something, in the words of President Park, was dialogue for peace and prosperity in Northeast Asia. And then what she had in mind was this, which is that among East Asian countries, we don't have the habit, or we don't have the record, of working closely among ourselves. So let us start somewhere. I mean, if we begin to speak about historical issues, if we begin to speak about territorial disputes, or if we begin to discuss about security issues, then maybe we cannot go very far. So let's start with less thorny issues. For example, nuclear safety. Nuclear safety is a highly important issue in Korea, in Japan, in China, in large number of other Asian countries. So how about starting our habit and record of cooperation on nuclear safety issue? Well, what about climate change? It's a very important issue, again, in Korea, in Japan, in China. So why don't we start to try to come up with common efforts we can make in order to better deal with the challenges of climate change? Or how to deal with disaster relief? Or how to deal with challenges of cybersecurity? These are the kind of issues we think are common challenges we have in Korea, in China, in Japan. So let us just get ourselves into the habit of cooperation on those issues. And then from there, we can expand the scope of our cooperation to other areas as well. So that's the background of President Park coming up with her idea of this proposal of Dialogue for Peace and Prosperity in Northeast Asia. And then that proposal was made in May. So it is still new. And then as an ambassador of Korea in Washington, D.C., I, in fact, have started my conversation with my American counterparts so that we will have better understanding of where we come from. And then, of course, once it develops itself into a more concrete ideas, then, of course, we will have to get the support of the United States for that idea as well. Thank you.
There are a number of questions related to China, and perhaps the best way to ask this question is really against the backdrop of the regional cooperation that you were talking about. And so knowing that China, for sure, we can take that they're going to be very important related to North Korea, let's just sort of set that aside. What are the other priorities for South Korea related to China? And perhaps you can put it in the context of this regional cooperation. And you alluded to some degree, about some of the territorial disputes that have occurred as well, which I think has caused, is a source of concern, whether it's in the East Sea, you know, China, South China Sea, or whether it's the Senkaku Diatai Islands as well. So it's sort of an open-ended question. Maybe you can tell us briefly about what you think the priorities are for South Korea related to China.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to China, then of course, I think important changes have been taking place in China. I should be very cautious. I came to find that there are a large number of audience coming from China as well. So I should be very cautious. But I think when it comes to China, all the important changes began to take place beginning from late 1970s under the leadership of Mr. Deng Xiaoping. And then when we think about Deng Xiaoping, then the best adage we remember about what Deng Xiaoping said was black cat or white cat, isn't it? Black cat or white cat. It doesn't matter whether it's a black cat or a white cat. If the cat catches the mice well, then there is a good cat, right? So that is the best adage we remember from many of the things which has been stated by Mr. Deng Xiaoping. But personally, there is another adage which I admire. And that adage is, hide your light and bide your time. Hide your light, bide your time, right? I mean, I guess it was Deng Xiaoping's idea that there is light in China. But if you, well, flag it too often, then maybe you could be threatening some of your neighbors. So the best idea is to hide your light and bide your time. So that was one of the things which had been stated by Mr. Deng Xiaoping late in 1970s. But my observation is, in China, many people seem to be thinking that China, over the past several decades, have gone through many important changes, economically, politically, diplomatically, and then maybe that adage, China is growing too big for that adage. That seems to be impression back in Korea, if my observation goes correctly. And I think it is inevitable that China will have to rise and then maybe show some of its light and then maybe declare that its time has come. But what we expect from China would be that rise, that inevitable rise, would be peaceful than other way around. So peaceful rise of China would be something which would be extremely beneficial to Northeast Asia, to East Asia, to the global community, and most importantly, to China as well. So that, I think, is something we expect to see from China, and then I'm pretty sure that's the vision of China for a large number of Chinese people as well.
Let's then now sort of go from regional back now specifically to South Korea. Mm-hmm. Very quickly, it's been, if you can, just, it's been about a year since the free trade agreement has come into force. We've had about maybe 15, 16 months. Can you give us a preliminary assessment of how you think that's going?
Well, when it comes to KOROS FTA, there are three important elements in the KOROS FTA, or economic activities between Korea and the United States, which is taking place. And then one of them would be trading goods, right? Trading goods. And another would be trading services. And then third would be flow of investment between our two countries. And then, Philip, as you rightly pointed out, the CORUS FTA is 1 year old now. It entered into force on March 15th, 2012. So now it is a little more than a year now since CORUS FTA entered into force. When it comes to trading goods, we have a little bit of surplus vis-a-vis in our trade relationship with the United States. When it comes to trading services, United States has important surplus vis-a-vis Korea. When it comes to investment, there is far larger amount of investment coming from Korea to United States rather than investment being made from United States to Korea. So in other words, in balance, when you put them all together, trading goods, trading services, and then investment, put them together, there is good balance between Korea and then the United States. And what is important is the size of our economic exchanges, it is growing again and again. And I think that is what is important.
Okay.
So we are rather encouraged about 1 year achievement of CORUS FTA, and then we hope that as it matures, then we'll be able to benefit even more out of CORUS FTA.
We have maybe time for two more quick questions. One I was really struck by had to do with Korean culture. And we know that Samsung is a big piece of our products and the things that we see every day in our homes. We know that Psy with Gangnam Style has made a huge impact. And so Korean culture is sort of on the move.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously you can't necessarily read the future, but what are your hopes and aspirations for Korean culture here in the United States? And I think it's apropos because this is something that we were hoping, I think, that the Korean Free Trade Agreement was going to cement, was this kind of relationship between the United States and South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of your reactions as to what your hopes and aspirations are for Korean culture here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, Philip, one of the things I told you about why I'm confident about the future of our bilateral relationship to strengthen in the days to come, it is because of diversity of our relationship. And I think cultural exchange would be a very good example of this diversity and richness and depth of our bilateral relationship. So, well, when it comes to our understanding of each other, then, of course, trade relationship is important. Security relationship is important. And then, diplomatic relationship is important. But at the same time, I think the most important relationship would be a people-to-people relationship, including better cultural understanding. So, well, personally, I'm extremely grateful to Psy for having popularized, say, Gangnam Style, as well as K-pop culture here in the United States, as well as in California. I'm deeply grateful. The other day, I came to visit Beijing, and then I was speaking at Foreign Service Institute there in Beijing. And then one student raised a hand and then asked me, well, Psy is doing so well in Korea, in the United States, and around the world. So what kind of support has Korean government been providing to Psy so that he could be doing it? And I said, well, Psy would, in fact, be much disappointed if somebody asked him what kind of support have you been getting from the Korean government, because in fact we are not providing any support at all, right? But I said maybe that will not be a very candid answer. Maybe something we provided to young people like Psy, which is from early on we have been saying, I mean Korean presidents, they have been saying that, well, Korea is such a small country, you have to go out, you have to prove yourself globally, rather than trying to prove yourself within the country. That's something our leaders have been telling our young generation and again. And that may partly explain why we have 70,000 students in this country, and that partly explain why Psy has been doing so well, and then it will partly explain why I, as a government official, think it's very important for me to continue to work further so that there will be more exchanges of people and culture between Korea and then the United States. In that sense, I'm extremely happy about something which happened between our two countries, which is visa waiver program, we waived visa between Korea and then the United States. So Korean tourists, whenever they want, and then whoever want, they can come anytime for tourist visa for the purpose of short-term visit. And then there was this CORUS FTA, which again, I think will go a long way in further strengthen and promote exchanges of people and ideas and the goods between Korea and then the United States. And then there is something I am working personally, and then there is professional visa for Korea. As I told you, there are 70,000 Korean students in this country, and a large number of them wish to remain back in this country and then continue to work in this country. For the time being, not too many of them are being able to do that. Why? Because it is extremely difficult to get professional visa for the time being. So for the time being, I'm working to create professional visa for Korea. And then I very much hope that I will be able to get your support for that cause as well. Because it will be good for Korea, and it will be good for Korea-U.S. relationship, and then that way it will be good for the United States as well. Thank you.
So perhaps right now this is a good note to end our program, not on Psy, but on people-to-people contact and young people, and your particular visit here as ambassador to spread that word. Mm-hmm. So please join me in thanking Ambassador An Ho-young for a wonderful set of remarks. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, thank you very much for joining us, and I want to thank everyone here in the audience for some wonderful questions.
Thank you so much for your time. And then the moment I came into this hall, I was looking around and I was admiring all those beautiful flags representing major countries and the major allies of the United States. And I was wondering why we don't have the flag of Korea. I see. Okay, thank you so much.
Right behind you.